No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I hope my show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. Tonight, we have a special guest, somebody that I follow in the Washington Post, Petula Dvorak, who's a columnist with the Post, and she writes about homeless shelters, gun control, high heels, high school choirs, the politics of jails and abortion clinics, mayors, modern family, strip clubs, something I know about, gas prices, and D.C. statehood. She's been with the Post for more than 15 years, and before joining the Post, she worked on social issues and covered courts in New Orleans, New Jersey, and Los Angeles. She earned a BA in journalism from USC, and we're so happy to have her here tonight. And I got to tell you, can I call you Petula?
Of course, please.
Okay.
That's the nicest thing anyone calls me this week.
Well, you know what? Yeah, you couldn't think of something bad enough to call me that I haven't been called. But Petula, you know, I'm from North New Jersey, and I spent one of the best summers of my life in a little backwater called Chalmette, right outside of New Orleans. So you know, it's like we're, you know, it's kismet. We were meant to be together. But
absolutely.
Let me ask you, let me start the conversation by talking about your most recent column, because it is Memorial Day, and I was very distressed to hear on the news that they had done a poll, and 60% of the people they polled didn't know what Memorial Day was about. And you've written a column which deals with the children who are survivors of military people who have actually made the ultimate sacrifice for America. And I think this is such an important thing. You want to talk about that a little bit, because they really, you know, this is really a forgotten bunch of people, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's that poll, those polls were so distressing. Why is it always 60%? You know, we had it's somehow there's just a little more than a majority of folks who deeply disappoint us. And that one equally disappointed me. And it is all too easy to make Memorial Day a weekend about barbecues and mattress and appliance sales. The start of the summer, radio stations, let's get your grill on. And forgetting that unless you're probably a family member who has lost someone very close, it's hard to remember what this day is about. And it's gone back in history. It started as Decoration Day. A lot of Memorial Days were held, and in many cases, in the Confederacy, the defeated Confederacy decorated the fallen Confederates' graves with flowers. So it's always been a day of remembrance. And somehow, as this is one of those things as a columnist, as you said, I've been doing the column for 15 years. I've been with the Post. This is my 25-year anniversary. And
wow.
I've covered, federal lands and the ceremonies here in D.C. And it's one of those things, you know, coming up with a column for each holiday. Sometimes it's a little difficult to say something different. But it really struck me this time thinking about the people whose lives are still affected by the deaths of our service members. And they make the ultimate sacrifice. And too often it's seen as something in the history books. And we did a wonderful series, a really searing and touching series a few years back about the children left behind in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, American children of service members who were left behind. And I was just thinking, wow, these kids are probably adults now. And it also got me thinking a little bit about what happens to these children when they are adults and have lived their whole lives without their parents because of a war, and in some cases a war that happened many, many years ago. So I dug into that a little bit, and it was really interesting to speak with Colleen Shine, the daughter of an Air Force Lieutenant Colonel who was shot down in Vietnam, and his death when she was 8. It has followed her whole life. And for people like her, Memorial Day is a lot more than the mattress sale and barbecue season.
Yeah, absolutely. And it never goes away, does it? It's I think it's especially poignant to me because of the Vietnam War. You know, when those guys came back from Vietnam, we wanted to ignore what had happened in Vietnam because we lost, you know, and that's who we are. Mm-hmm. But, and I know that, I got to tell you, one of the greatest honors I think I've received is that I went to, give a speech in the Navy Memorial one day, and I didn't know where I was supposed to be. So I came in and I asked the guy at the information desk where to go. And he told me, I said, I'm Senator Brown. I'm here to give a speech. And when I came out, he called to me and he pulled down a picture that he had behind him in the information booth. And it was a picture of a Navy ship with like 7 men on the deck and him. Mm-hmm. And he told me a story about each member. You know, he said, this is Joe so-and-so. He was a baseball player, blah, blah, blah. And he went on to the next guy. And at the end, he said, all 7 of them were killed in the war but me. I was the only survivor. And I was just touched by the fact that he would share something so personal like that with me. And I realized that people need to talk about these things. They need to be right. I got that out of your article too, that all these people want to talk about it. They all need some kind of closure or recognition of the sacrifice that their family made. And the good news in your story is that now they're coming together to do that, right? The Gold Star, what we call Gold Star children, or they're sharing their stories and they have therapy and things like that. So it's getting better for them.
Absolutely. And it was something that was so interesting to me because I know when we did launch those invasions and have those wars and started seeing those war orphans, that was kind of one of the stories that many of us did. TAPS, Good Grief, these are all organizations that have camps and counseling for those young kids that are now parentless. And that is, it is different, and that is a very good way of dealing with it. But like you said, I also found in researching this, a lovely woman named Ann Bennett Mix, whose father died in World War II, and she'd never met until her 50s. Right. She'd never met another war orphan, and she started a group, and there's hundreds of them now, and they've gone back to Europe to see their father's graves. They've gathered, and they've actually finally been able to talk about not having a father for grade school, graduation, marriage, right. Everything. Mm. So yes, we have gotten much better at and helping those children, and it's really great to see that adults and in some cases adults in their 80s are able to actually address that grief, and I hope that the nation respects their grief and also shares in it and acknowledges that these people have had decades without a parent in honor of our wars.
Well, and you know, I think it was a really important story to do. My brother was an F-111 pilot, and I watched him in a career that he had in the Air Force. I watched him drag my sister-in-law and his children all over the planet. You know, we forget that those people serve as well, right? My sister-in-law must have moved 6 or 7 times with him, and it was always new school for the kids, and you know, and moving everything, and they also serve. Not to mention worrying about every time they climb in the cockpit. You know, that's another thing. Well, let's
I wanted to be so courteous to make a little plug with your time for another organization. I found Children of Fallen Patriots. And because you said that, there was a young woman who I spoke with who now lives in Virginia. She went to 25 schools and ultimately lost her father as well. But she's working for this organization, Children of Fallen Patriots. Fallen Patriots is how you find them. And they pay the college tuitions of kids who lost parents to war. And those two wars, Afghanistan and Iraq, now have a lot of kids in their 20s who don't have a way to go through college. And giving to those organizations is a great way to celebrate Memorial Day tomorrow.
Yeah, but absolutely. And you know what? I'm not really sure why the government doesn't do that. Why the government doesn't pay for their tuition. Yeah. But yes, please, if you have a website or whatever, you're welcome to give that as well. But let's move on to something a little more fun. Yes. You did a column on the cat fight in Congress. What, you know, and it's funny that the day after Marjorie Taylor Greene attacked Ms. Crockett, the congresswoman, right, Jasmine Crockett, the congresswoman from Texas, the day after that, she was a keynote speaker at the Democratic committee's dinner that I attended, a local Democratic committee, and she was fabulous. She must have been great. Yeah, she's such a dynamic speaker. And you know, and there were people that had already shown up. Now this was the next day. People were already at the dinner with the T-shirts that she was putting out with that comment that she made about Marjorie Taylor Greene.
But the alliterative comment. And I saw on the YouTube, there were a few folks who already made songs about it.
And I mean, it's just, if you were a comedian, right, because you're a columnist, so you get this. If you were a comedian, you must love people like Donald Trump and Marjorie Taylor Greene and Bobart and some of these people that say such ridiculous things.
Absolutely. Congressman, delicious material.
and it's crazy. Some of the things they say, I just can't believe. They just make stuff up as they go along. I mean, I've been in politics for 40 years, and hyperbole is what politicians deal in. But there's a difference between hyperbole and just standing up there and bald-faced lying. I mean, it doesn't even enter their wheelhouse that they may be doing something wrong. But let me ask you, do you seem to suggest, excuse me, I don't know if this is true, that this is a coming of age for women in Congress. Do you think it is? Do you think it really is?
I was trying to be a little bit cheeky, of course, but as soon as that blew up and I looked at my social media, you know, and I saw all these comments, that's what you get with women in Congress, democracy, bring them into Congress. And I just got so infuriated because, you know, dudes have been doing this for years, for centuries. Come on. Men have been fighting over petty stuff, as well as, you know, drawing arms and they're going at each other for years. This isn't a woman thing. And it reminded me of that quote, which I couldn't seem to find. I saw someone attribute it to Barbara Jordan, but I know it wasn't. I don't think it was her who said it, but it's kind of one of these truisms that you see, women only, equality is only reached when women can be as mediocre as men. And this just seemed to me that, this is perhaps women are finally showing that they can be as petty and argumentative as any men, because for the most part, the, you know, I was, we've only had one kind of sordid scandal with, you know, one member of Congress that may have been having alleged affairs with staff members who was a female. But outside of that, women have not, women, their time in Congress has not been nearly as juicy and salacious as men's. And so I thought, well, perhaps we're finally reaching a sad common denominator here.
Well, you know, I'm proud to say that I've had four employees in my life, and they've all been women. And I think that just shows how smart I am, because women work harder.
Absolutely.
You know, right? They work harder. They're more loyal. Unfortunately, I hate to say this, you can pay them less. And they you know, and if you treat women well, they'll do, you know, they'll work their rear ends off for you, you know, because they're so used to getting poor treatment or being talked down to or not being treated as equals. If you're, you know, every woman I've ever had that worked for me was a partner and not an employee, really. And I think that's really key. They've all been amazing people. I often want to say to them, why did you ever bother to work for me? You're so much better than that. But, you know, yeah. you point out, for example, where this guy Mullen, Congressman Mullen, threatened the Teamster President O'Brien during his, you know, kind of said, take him out of the hall. And as a former Teamster, I was proud of the fact that O'Brien pretty much said to him, you want a piece of me? Fine. Here I am. You know, I mean, yeah, right? You cover things in New Jersey. You don't threaten Hell's Angels, and you don't threaten Teamsters. It's just not a, you know, it's not going to lead to a good outcome for you. But that was interesting. And you're right. You're so right about the what's gone on with these guys over the years. I mean, it's just been incredible. I worked at the DNC. I was a DNC staffer for almost 4 years, and I just knew so many women that had to put up with so much nonsense at the hands of politicians. I agree with you a little. I hope that women don't digress to the point that men have, you know, I think you're right. I think it's about time that we
act like absolute fools, just like the men do, and it goes unnoticed, just like the men have often.
Right.
their squabbles have gone unnoticed. So for, again, that's a little bit of parody in the swamp, but parody takes its form in many different ways.
Yeah, it sure does. And you know, I think I got a good lesson the first time I ever covered, I'll never forget this, covering a congressional hearing as a graduate student at the University of Maryland. And I walked into the committee, and the committee clerk was one of the prettiest women I'd ever seen in my life. And her name was Miss Love. And I'm thinking, no homie girls ever apply for a job at this place, because every staffer was just, you know, looked like they just walked out of a Vogue magazine. Of course, that was a long time ago, but a little more casual these days. But
what happened probably is homely women did apply, but they didn't get the job.
Exactly. I mean, exactly. Right. Where that's not a problem if you're a man. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Let's take a look at Mitch McConnell. He's not, you know, there aren't any women hitting on Mitch McConnell. Or not many, anyway. It's really unfortunate. And I've worked for several women politicians, and they've been just amazing people. You know, I've known some amazing men as well, but I think you're right. I think it's about time that you get equal billing. Let's talk for a second, if you don't mind, about the column you wrote about Byron Donalds, who's this lovely Republican from Florida who just passed a bill in the House, which is got the most ridiculous name. It's, you know, it's like saving the people of the District of Columbia from themselves. Policing Act of 2024. I mean, it's called the DC Crimes Act, but yes. But it's got a longer title, like, which is just absolutely ridiculous. And you point out that one of the things that this bill does is it rolls back, it keeps us from changing any sentencing laws, any kind of leniency in sentencing or anything else that we might adjust sentencing laws. And you point out that Mr. Donalds was busted twice in New York, once for possession and intent to distribute pot, and another for I can't remember the second charge for bribery or fraud. Yeah, and that he was given a lenient sentence by the judge, and then he had his record expunged. Because that's really hard. I've run for political office 3 times, and it's a really tough question to get at a forum when somebody says, you know, tell us about the many times you've been arrested, Congressman. You know, having it expunged from your record is a really good thing. Bribery was the other charge. Eleanor Holmes Norton has called this the biggest rollback of home rule in a generation. And it's just, again, these guys are such hypocrites that it's incredible to me. But I'm really, really angry at the city council for sending a crime bill up there. And we'll talk about the undocumented voting bill in a minute. But they sent a crime bill up there several months ago. It was summarily rejected. I called them petulant children for doing it because the mayor had vetoed the bill, and they overrode her veto and that unanimously the next day and sent it up there. And I said, it reminded me of coming home and finding my teenagers drunk on the living room floor with a bottle of wine and have one of them get it up and ask if they could borrow the car. You know, it's like, why didn't they get no, right? That's what it reminded me. It reminded me of my 13-year-old daughter telling me what she was going to do. You know, I'm the only, she stood up and stamped her little feet and said, I'm the only 13-year-old in the world without a cell phone. This was many years ago. She's now 31. But I said to her mother, do you think she really believes that? That all the children in China and all the children in Africa and all the children everywhere in the world have cell phones but her? And her mother said, yes, she does. But of course, she didn't, you know, I said, no, you're not getting a cell phone. I'm the one that's going to buy it. So, you know, and that's what it reminded me of. A much better approach was my younger daughter, who wanted a car when she was in college and used to call me on her cell phone walking home and say things like, Daddy, I just want to talk to you because I'm walking down a really dark street and there's a bunch of scary guys standing at the corner. And I don't, you know, I mean, that worked. Mm-hmm. I said, oh, you're getting a car the next day. But and I wonder why the DC council didn't do that. Why didn't they understand? The Republicans have made the centerpiece of their down ballot races, especially crime. Yes. And so we send up a crime bill that reduces the penalties for carjacking and murder, which are all both way up far above what the average was last year. And so we've opened the door for these guys to attack the Democratic Party. I mean, this is, we couldn't have done a better job of, and they've done it 3 times so far. They've gotten rid of the crime bill. They've gotten rid of the 2022 policing bill, which then the president vetoed, and the Non-Resident Voting Act. They've gotten, now that may not pass in the Senate, but it may pass in the Senate. We lost 44 Democrats on the first bill and the president of the United States, and we've lost 58 Democrats on this last bill. And I just don't know why these guys, you know, did they forget that that Congress has the ultimate say? Much like my 13-year-old daughter forgot that she didn't have any money. That's exactly what it reminded me of. And the mayor vetoed it and didn't sign the second bill. So I don't know why they're not getting it. I don't have progressives gone too far in D.C.?
Well, I think that this what it reminds me of is a little bit like the slogan during much of the Black Lives Matter movement, the defund the police slogan, which I think was a very, very ill thought out slogan.
Yes.
So a very necessary movement. I wrote a column saying it shouldn't be defund the police. It should be reimagine the police.
Right.
We obviously need to have police reform in this country. That's a given. There are thousands upon thousands of very good police officers, and there are some very bad police officers, and we need to address that. But defunding the police, like it's exactly what you said. It opens the door to a lot of criticism. Right. And in fact, I think ended up fueling a lot of this backlash. I'd been a crime reporter in, as you mentioned, Los Angeles, New Jersey, and New Orleans here for many years, and I couldn't talk to a police officer who I really admired and I thought was good without hearing a bitterness and an anger because of that slogan, even though in many cases that is not at all what happened. Abolish the police, that didn't happen. Defunding the police, maybe reallocating funds for better policing, for community policing, a little more community policing and beat patrols versus really cool gear like armored vehicles that a lot of small departments got after 9/11, because that was a lot of fun. Kind of militarization of police was what really damaged our nation. And rather than defunding them, we had to reimagine the way we did it. And I feel like this crime bill was a little bit like that. It was 16 years in the works. We hadn't addressed our crime, our code and our sentencing guidelines for 16 years, and they needed to be addressed. And probably changing the sentencing guidelines for crimes that were so passionately noticed and are so dangerous are rising was not a good idea, and it tanked a whole package that actually did have some good and necessary reforms.
Right.
And so it was, I think that was a little bit what happened. I wish that it had been reimagined and did not leave the door wide open, because as you said, this is an unprecedented in 30 years attack on home rule, and it's preposterous.
Right.
And what's funny about it, as you noticed, with Byron Donalds, every time the Republican legislators, as you said, they're using attacks on Democratic cities as proxy wars for the culture war they're mounting for the coming elections. And each time they attack D.C., it's almost ironic and delicious the way it happens, right? Byron Donalds saying that we're too lenient on juvenile crime victims.
Right.
And I saw that day, and I was just looking at my phone and seeing the stories coming out of it. And I said, I wonder what his past is like. And it was like Christmas that he himself has had this spectacular career because of lenient sentencing. He was a young student. He had just moved from New York to Florida when he was caught with possession. And it was, the charge was intent to distribute. I think in some interviews he said that was not the case, that he wasn't dealing. But neither here nor there, like you said, he got through the very laborious task of getting it expunged. But the same irony went for, you remember when former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy attacked D.C., standing on the House floor talking about a carjacking that happened on Capitol Hill, that Capitol Police had stopped right by the Hill a couple days before when he was mounting an attack on Democrat cities and, using D.C. in his crusade. Huh. Well, he's from Bakersfield. I know that place. Bakersfield, I looked, and just that week, there was a wild, absolutely wild, like guns running, people, it was like a movie scene, carjacking chase right through the center of downtown Bakersfield that day. And it also turns out that his territory, Bakersfield, is routinely crowned by the insurance industry the car theft capital of the nation. So the hypocrisy of these leaders who have their own problems at home, putting their energy into the district, is the stuff that absolutely boils my blood.
Well, yeah. And they pushed 44 Democrats into a corner and the president of the United States. President Biden said he would veto the bill, but then when all the Democrats backed out on it, because they were afraid of what's going on in the campaigns in their local districts. I mean, it was just amazing to me, and especially since the mayor vetoed it on the basis that it reduced the penalties for carjacking and murder. And you know what? Any bill that hasn't been reformed in 100 years probably needs to be reformed. That was never the case with me, right? But these guys are right. Such hypocrites. You point out a couple of others, but one of my favorites, and I don't know if this is before your time or not, but do you remember Bob Bauman? Bob Bauman was the most anti-gay member of Congress, and he was right. from the Eastern Shore, and his family owned the Bauman Bible Company, which had a contract with the Gideons. So they printed every Bible for every hotel room in America, and they did very, very well. He was very, very wealthy. And he was accidentally found out to be a child pornographer when the D.C. police were doing an undercover investigation, and his car kept on showing up at all these places they were investigating. So he didn't last very long in Congress after that. But the hypocrisy for these guys, exactly. Another one that got us was Gary Hart. Gary Hart dated a woman in my office for years. We were so surprised when that news story came out about the monkey business. Yeah, like people didn't know this. Oh my God! Funny. We had a there's such, we could go on all night about how
hypocritical they are. And Byron Donalds ended up taking the seat that Trey Radel abandoned years ago. He was the congressman from Donald's Florida district who took to the House floor insisting that welfare recipients, food stamps, programs, food benefit programs all be drug tested. Within days after that, he was arrested at DuPont Circle in an undercover operation because he'd been a very, very frequent cocaine buyer right in our own town, fueling our drug trade here. So we see that again and again. And the part that just really, that's all, banter that anyone who's lived in Washington for amount of time and rolls their eyes at the clowns that circle through here and turn this into the scorn of the nation and forget that there are people who live here, work here, and do make our government run right. Without dealing with the clowns who come and squat here for a few years. But the thing that's so infuriating is that home rule is being challenged, and that is a fight that we have had here since 1840, trying to just get the same rights that the rest of Americans have. And the way that is being bandied about is infuriating. And I don't think the rest of the nation, I love that you open your podcast with that song. Because I just, even as I, talk to friends all around the nation, I think people really don't understand the lack of rights that still exist here in D.C. When, in the 50s and the 60s, when Congress ran D.C. thanks to the committee on the district. Yeah. It was one of the crappiest committee assignments. And guys who get elected in their, you know, hometown, yay, national office, and they get to D.C., and guess what? They're right back on the city council determining, you know, school lunch fees and teacher transportation or bus transportation issues or teacher salaries. And that is not what they were elected to do. And the council members or the Congress members who were put on that committee who did not want to be council members knew it was about their ego then, but they knew that that was not their job. And it's astonishing to me that we have a whole new generation of members of Congress who want to go back to being council members here in D.C. It's not their job.
Yeah, and you know what? We find out that generally they don't want to bother with D.C. They only bother with it when they feel they can use it for some, exactly, you know, purpose like what we've been talking about, to highlight the fact that we're all Democrats in D.C., you know, 78% of our registered voters are Democrat, never elected a mayor that wasn't a Democrat, never voted for a president that wasn't a Democrat, you know, that they can hold that up. But in defense of the guy from Florida, since most of the cocaine comes in through Florida, maybe he was just promoting local commerce, you know, which is part of his job, right? Yeah, he was out there trying to get more business from Florida. But yeah, it is crazy. And you know, it's, you know, my father was a con man. And I grew up, that's true. It's a true story. And I grew up, we moved around a lot because people were always after him. But that's how we got to Washington. But from Newark, New Jersey, of all places. But, you know, his ability to look you straight in the eye and be very sincere and then take money from, take your Social Security check, never ceased to amaze me. And these guys can all do that. He would have been a great politician if he had a better education. But let me ask you, since we're on the subject of, you know, progressives going a little far, in my opinion, what do you think about ranked choice voting?
Do you think that that's something that goes too far?
Yeah. You know why? Because in 2016, 178,827 people in the District of Columbia did not use their second vote for city council because they can't figure out how that works, voting for two people for the same office. And in 2022, 82,000. I mean, it's getting a little better, I guess. 82,000 people didn't use their second vote, which was 40% of the votes cast. So if we can't figure out how to make two choices, how are we going to make five choices in each office? I mean, it's just crazy. You know that I ran for city council. I was one of 13 people. I had no money. I spent no money. But we put people out at the polling places with T-shirts on that said, make your second vote count. And I came in one spot away from winning a seat on the city council out of 13 people. Because most people didn't understand that they could use their second vote. And I just think it's crazy. I also think that we get the second best person a lot of the time by using it, right? Because you don't go for the guy that got the most votes necessarily. You move on to the second person if they didn't get more than 50% of the vote. But what I think is brilliant on the part of my friend, local activist Adam Eidegger, is that he's tied to the bill, and this is Initiative 83, which is likely to be on the ballot. He's tied to the bill, the right for independents to vote in either primary, and I think that's something that most people agree upon. I think, you know, my experience talking to people is that a lot of them believe, independents should be able to vote in either primary? Why should they be closed out, especially in the District of Columbia? You know, when you win the primary, I'm sure you're aware of this, when you win the Democratic primary, you go out on Election Day and give donuts out to people at the polls. That's what I do. I don't even campaign, you know? And people call you after the primary and say, congratulations on your election. You know, I mean, and that's pretty much the way it goes. So I understand letting independents vote and not closing them out of the process. And I think that was smart to put that on the bill, because I think that's what's going to appeal to people. That's why it looks like Adam already has close to 30,000 signatures, which is 7,000 signatures more than he needs to get on the ballot. So it's going to be on the ballot. I hope people understand it. I think it's crazy. I think they're pushing us too far. And you know, the defund the police thing, that I so felt that as soon as it happened, just like you, because I was a PR guy for the Democrats for 25 years. Uh-huh. I ran a direct mail firm. So, you know, yeah, I felt the same thing. It's like, oh, my God, how can you say that? It's like, it's the same feeling I got when, was it Mondale or Dukakis that climbed in the tank? I think it was Dukakis.
Oh, that was Dukakis.
Yeah, they climbed in the tank. And I was at the DNC and we all saw it on TV. And it was like everybody in the room went silent. They were like, what? You know, right?
Can I make an exclusive confession to you about that?
Yes, please.
So you had noted that I went to USC. I went to the University of Spoiled Children in Southern California, also known as Felon University, because we seem to produce an extraordinary amount. I mean, I think most of the White House plumbers have gone to USC. So, but it was, for me, it was a full ride to a journalism school that was in my home state. So that made me excited. And that's why I went. And it was a fantastic journalism school. But when I started, I worked for, I'm aging myself now, but I was so excited to get into the big city. And I worked for George Bush's presidential campaign with the College Republicans of USC. And we made a poster for the College Republicans meeting using that picture of Dukakis in the tank.
Yeah, well,
and he
you
had
know,
a UCLA sweatshirt too. So,
well, we were the... I was part of the group that put together the picture of George Bush looking at his watch at the debate. And we publicized it as "It's time to go," you know. Yeah. Yeah. In fact, one time, I'll make a confession to you. One time they made the suggestion at a meeting that I was having at the DNC that I was part of, where we had a thing called the campaign to save Social Security, because that's been the mantra of the Democrats for a long time. These guys are going to take your Social Security. So we put together a document that when you took it out of the envelope, it was a Social Security card, and it fell apart when you took it out of the envelope. And we decided that was a little too radical, you know, that. But yeah, we weren't above.
That was a great PR strategy, though.
Yeah, we weren't above those tactics. And I assume you worked for the good George Bush, the first George Bush.
Yes,
he was a hero. He really was an American hero, even though I didn't agree with him a lot of the time. But he was an amazing man. Yeah, I just think that progressives are, you know, we need to... The defund the police is really even a clearer example for me than the ranked choice voting, because that was just crazy. It's like, you know,
it was just the wrong messaging. Such a good message, but just the wrong wording. The wrong wording that just gave everyone a huge open door, and all the way from, you know, to see it on the, you know, the House and Senate floor being used, but it was used in police stations everywhere. I mean, you know, stupid, stupid, around that time, just a stupid example, I was deep in the farmland of Maryland when my car broke down and a state trooper picked us up, my family and I, and all he could talk about was defund the police. And, you know, they took it so very personally and not understanding. Yeah. But every one of those guys who took it so personally would probably absolutely disagree with police brutality.
Right.
But it was a disastrous message, and I think that's exactly the same way that DC crime bill was presented, disastrously, in a situation that needed to happen and had some very good points to it.
Yeah, well, yeah, absolutely. And my children, both my girl, I have three kids, two girls and a boy, and both my daughters explained defunding the police to me. What it meant.
Yeah.
And I said, I get what it means, you know,
yeah.
But it's the way, you know, it's the way it's being said. It doesn't come across that way to people. And, you know, we always have to be careful. I don't know why we're not more strategic sometimes. We let, you know, I've done a lot of campaigning in my life, worked on a lot of campaigns. And one thing we don't want the candidate to do generally is to proceed without guardrails, without people around him advising him. Because if he just goes from his gut, there's a lot of problems with that. And one of the clearest examples for me is when I was in graduate school. Now I'm going to date myself. I was covering a new piece of relatively new piece of legislation, the Equal Rights Amendment. And, you know, it was a great lesson that what the people that pushed the Equal Rights Amendment did was they used people like, I don't know if you remember these commercials, Alan Alda and I don't know, Jane Fonda and all these people, and they would say, support ERA or pass ERA. Well, these were people that were preaching to people that already believed in the Equal Rights Amendment. You know, they weren't getting any new people. There weren't any conservative people in the middle of Iowa saying, oh, I love that Jane Fonda, you know. Meanwhile, this little old housewife, Shapley, who we all made fun of from Ohio or Indiana or wherever the hell she was, went and got a woman general. And the woman general sat up in front of the TV and said, this bill will send your daughters to war. And man, that was effective, right?
Brilliant.
Yeah, brilliant in comparison. And so, you know, we always have to be strategic about this stuff, especially with these guys. I mean, they're just amazing, you know. Go ahead.
Well, I'm sorry, just to piggyback what you're saying. So I think that taxation without representation is brilliant and tells everyone what they think. It tells everyone what exactly, you know, what it means. And what I wonder is why they are not seeing that messaging. You know, our own Byron Donalds was a big guy with the Tea Party. How is that? That's brilliant messaging, taxation without representation. Why can't that one break through?
Well, I think because the people in the District of Columbia don't care about this. 84% of us support the idea of statehood. We put it out on a referendum. But the government puts no money into it. They call it a priority. But, you know, the first I've been in office 18 years. I'm retiring in January. But I've been in office 18 years. And for 9 years, I paid for everything out of my own pocket. I'm not paid. Yeah. And I do this full time. I've done it for 15 years with no other employment. And I'm not paid. My office isn't supported. We hardly put any money into it. We go up there and we send the mayor and the chairman of the city council, who haven't even been elected, to this position. We've been elected to do this. This is what our mandate says, that we're supposed to go up to Congress. But we send them up there to say we pay taxes and we fight in wars. Well, there's not a single member of the United States Congress that does not understand that we pay taxes and we fight in wars. In fact, we pay the highest per capita taxes in America, and we had the highest per capita casualties during the Vietnam War. So we just do the same old, same old, same old. And taxation without representation, representation is a tough slogan to pay to sell to people that understand we pay the highest taxes in America because we're the richest people in America. It's hard to feel sorry for us, right? I mean, we make more money than anybody, and that's why we pay. We're also the most educated people on the face of the planet. There's more people with graduate degrees in the District of Columbia than any other city in the world. So it's hard for to feel sorry for us. And the people with power, you know this because you work for the Washington Post, the people with power, the people with power in the city know more about Hillary Clinton than they know about Muriel Bowser. We don't pay attention to local politics. And, you know, speaking of the Washington Post, they printed for the first time in yesterday's paper people that were running for my office. They've never even, in 31 years, this office has been out there for 31 years. People have been elected to it. Jesse Jackson was the first person. They've never mentioned it in the Post, not once. They've never endorsed a candidate. They've never talked about the candidates. Even though my title, my official title is United States Senator, they always refer to me as the shadow senator, you know. So nobody supports his idea, and that's why it's not happening, you know. Frederick Douglass told us 150 years ago, a power concedes nothing without a demand. We don't make a demand. We go up and act politely. And who do we send up? We send up two people that are co-opted. We send up the mayor and the chairman of the city council, which need to go to Congress every year and ask for tens of millions of dollars. We send them up to make our demand. Well, you know, and this is why I'm leaving office, because with the recent developments, it's not going anywhere for a long time, unfortunately, and I'm going to leave it to a younger person to carry on the fight, because we need to do it, right? We can't say, okay, we're going to sit on the back of the bus. We got to say no until it happens. And but it will happen, as Jesse Jackson said, when this is raised to the level of an insult to the people of the District of Columbia. I truly believe that. But yeah, everybody, you know, people don't know about this, and that's our problem. Nobody knows about this. You talk to your friends, you know, and so do I when we go out, but across the country. I've gone to 17 states to talk about this, but people don't know, you know. It's and we need to get the word out there, because most people agree with us. I even had a bunch of people. I had a bunch of Republicans walk by me on the mall one day. I forget what the event was. It was a big event. And I said something about, I would pass out literature on statehood. And this guy said to me, there were a group of them, there were like five of them. And this guy said to me, you just want two more Democrats in Congress, in the Senate. And I noticed that he was wearing a T-shirt, an Air Force T-shirt. And I said to him, we're trying to get people to sign a petition. And I said to him, 40,000 Democrats, 40,000 veterans in the District of Columbia do not have the same rights as people who have never served. And you know what? All five of them came back and signed a petition. That's what we need to do. That's what we need to do. We need to put up a billboard in West Virginia that says, well, it's too late for this now, but a couple of years ago, that said, your Senator Joe Manchin doesn't support the idea of veterans having equal rights. That's what we need to do. We need to embarrass a few of these people, right? Because this is what the country was founded on. Well, unfortunately, we've run out of time, and we haven't even gotten to talk about New Jersey and New Orleans, two of my favorite places. Where did you cover crime in New Jersey?
In Trenton.
Oh, in Trenton. That's really...
Yeah, right by that bridge. Trenton makes, the world takes. One of my favorite city slogans I've ever seen.
Mine too. And you know what? I never miss it when I go up on the train. But my wife came from this little place called Haddon Heights, which is like, it's like Princeton. You know, it looks like it was designed by Norman Rockwell. And I said, that's not New Jersey. Newark's New Jersey. That's where I'm from. Or Trenton's New Jersey. Or Jersey City's New Jersey. Right?
Yes, sir.
So you were in a real New Jersey. Well, God bless you. I will continue to read you in the post. We have a minute left. Is there anything you want to add?
I want to read you one line from this 1840 document of when the citizens of Georgetown stormed the mayor's office in 1840 demanding representation. And I love this line where they said, "We are governed without a knowledge of what is conducive to our own happiness. Thus, we are governed unjustly. We are governed purely on party and personal grounds as operating throughout the Union. Therefore, we are governed tyrannically." Don't anyone tell us that we are being hysterical right now. This has been going on for a long time.
Well, from your lips to God's ear, I hope that this happens soon. And you can never tell. I don't mean to paint such a dire picture of it. You never know what's going to happen. You know, I sat at the convention. I've been to 12 consecutive presidential nominating conventions as a delegate or some other office. And I sat there with a bunch of political consultants when President Obama gave his first speech at a convention. He was a senator from Illinois. And somebody said to me, who's this guy? And I said, he's a senator from Illinois. And they said, that's too bad because, you know, he could probably be president someday. And 4 years later, he was president. You know, so nobody, you know, and they were acting like, wow, isn't it a shame that he's black and he's from Chicago because otherwise he could make it. So you never know. And I'm hoping for the best. And because go ahead.
No, I'll say I just wanted to thank you, Senator Brown, for your work on behalf of the people of D.C. This is a long fight. You deserve to rest, but I sure hope that you see the end.
Yeah, me too. And you know what? We always dedicate a song to our guest, and we end the show with a song. And I couldn't think of anything else. As a former member of the Wheaton High School marching band, here's one by John Philip Sousa, The Washington Post, which was actually, I found out today, The Washington Post. I always thought because a post is a type of march, I often thought that that's what it was. But it was actually, The Washington Post actually got him to do it. And it became one of his most popular things. So here's the Marine Corps Band, The President's Own, with The Washington Post. And thank you, Petula. Enjoy the rest of your Memorial Day, and I hope we get to talk again soon.
Thank you, sir, so much. Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.